as she lies beneath his feet.
Enjoying the cool morning breeze, smelling flowers as he goes.
Looks like he changed his ways. Still pinching.
The media are prefabricated and they want to hear what they want to hear. So the Christian will tell them the truth. A Christian was in fear during the nightmare of this Arabic spring. The reality is that Western countries, they have supported radicalism and they are responsible of what is happening. They would like a kind of mono-color society. They speak about pluralism, maybe here for Europe, but where we are, they would like to split, to segregate people, to put every ethnic or every religion in a kind of ghetto.
And just finally, your thoughts are about events in Palestine. There's the Great Return March, Britain-Israeli government. How do you characterize events at the moment in Palestine?
Well, since the creation of the so-called Israel entity, what is happening is not fitting with human rights, neither with international laws. They say that it is the real democracy in the Middle East. If the real democracy is like this, what is left for dictatorship?
William. Got my point. I have to do that next week when I listen to this and replay. Well, of course, this week I replay last week's, and then I listen to myself.
Well, bad DJ. Well, what was last week's? Our Saudi crime partners are broadening the franchise by bombing school children in Yemen today. Well, this is old news. That's like over a year old. But anyway, it's sad how the news doesn't change. In alliance with our CIA Contra Army database, Al-Qaeda, the drone strike defense holiday WTC demolition patsies for your cheap Arab gas, gringos. To include you abolishing formal African slavery in 1962, that's our Saudi crime partners, to broaden the franchise, to include you gringos, if you like stop loss, you'll love Pinoc Pentagon's next moves. Non-unanimous verdicts by a 12-person jury were held to be constitutional by the United States and Supreme Court almost 40 years ago. See APO DACA versus Oregon. The court has recently declined to revisit that decision. See Barber versus Louisiana, 2011. Furthermore, APO DACA's application
that's APODACA, in this state, which is Louisiana, has been affirmed by the Louisiana Supreme Court, see State versus Bertrand, LA, 2009. 1 year earlier, however, in another case challenging the state's jury system, one that did sufficiently rouse state attorneys enough to see them file a brief with the justices in Washington, Louisiana made this dubious argument in support of its non-unanimous jury rule. Because 10 jurors, you can have two holdouts, two innocent votes, and still go, you know, slam up for life or death. It is difficult to perceive a qualitative difference between a jury composed of 10 returning a unanimous verdict and a jury composed of 12 returning a majority verdict of 10. In either case, the defendant has had the benefit of a trial by a jury of his peers, affording him the interposition of the common sense judgment of a group of laymen. Moreover, the burden placed upon the state in achieving such a conviction is identical. It must convince 10 citizens of the accused guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Unquote from the Louisiana. Let me just stick to the thing because they say it all. So this is the author of the article, and that was a quote from your government, well, the Louisiana state, but this is what passing for law under APODACA today. But it is not at all, quote, difficult to perceive a qualitative difference between a smaller jury that renders a unanimous verdict and a larger one that does not. In the first situation, no juror has voted to acquit, and there is no internal question about whether the state has satisfied its burden of proving its case beyond a reasonable doubt. In the second situation, the votes of dissenting jurors essentially are ignored, and there is a patent conflict within the jury about whether the state has met its burden of proof. And that's the, when I psychoanalyze myself, when I say, oh yeah, I must not be crazy. At least there's one other person, even if it's just me, who agrees.
What is...
case. In 1984, a plaintiff was first denied his right to give evidence based on racial criteria when Reading FBI agent John Riga refused to accept information of a Section 1116-1117 Title 18 violation by government employees after Agent Riga learned the murder victims he had already known were foreign civilians were Latin American in violation of plaintiff's rights under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, 42 U.S.C. Section 1981 and 28 U.S.C. Section 535B, plaintiff is of partial Hispanic descent. Among the relief which this case seeks is a declaration that the denial of plaintiff's right to due process of the law and the racial discrimination suffered by plaintiff in this specific incident was unlawful. The basis for federal jurisdiction cited in the district court was U.S. Constitution Article 3, Section 2, Article 6, Section 9-3, the Fifth Amendment, 28 U.S.C. Section 1343, 1346, 1361, 1391B, and or 1391E2, 5 U.S.C. Sections 702, 706, and 42 U.S.C. Section 1981. In 1981, plaintiff first heard the president had put out murder contracts against the government of Nicaragua. Congress responded by prohibiting attempts to overthrow that government. With the Boland Amendment, Congress had made such attempts punishable as homicide in Section 1116, 1117 of Title 18 and had required the reporting of government Title 18 violations in 28 U.S.C. Section 535B, the Ethics in Government Act. Plaintiff's first contacts with the California and U.S. Department of Justice arose from fear of personal attack and the desire to have law enforcement agencies aware of the organized crime figures he had begun to publish denunciations of in the press. Oh, yeah. So I think it was January 13th, Sacramento Bee had my... In 1983, hundreds of Nicaraguan school teachers and nurses were assassinated by U.S.-backed Contras. If we can sleep while our money pays for this, maybe we're not really waking up. And that was in my exhibits in the affidavit of reparable injury and the original complaint of in the press. Such attacks have, in fact, materialized. The case of People of California versus Edwards, the attached arrest form, Appendix B, involved an explicit threat against plaintiff's life and the destruction of his photographic equipment, as well as assault and battery. Plaintiff was required to make an excess of 6 visits to the Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office and request the arresting officer to send the DA's office a second report and complaint after the original was purportedly lost. The assailant was a contract employee of the U.S. military, and this was not the only time an employee of the U.S. military has so attacked and threatened plaintiff for the exercise of his First Amendment rights, and in which evidence of the attack has been lost or destroyed by law enforcement officers.
the chilling effect on free speech and the denial of plaintiffs' right to due process of the law from obstruction of justice and these other complaints is consistent with that experienced by plaintiff in the present case. Though the president had promised during re-election debates to punish those responsible for producing the CIA assassination manual, his Justice Department, in defense of William Casey in its 826-85 memorandum in Getty versus Casey in the district court below, see Appendix B, defended, quote, the propriety of the plan, unquote, in the Psychological Operations in Guerrilla Warfare manual named in paragraph 1 of plaintiff's original 1985 complaint against CIA Chief Casey. Plaintiff attempted to force the district court to confront the contradiction between the officially expressed policy on civilian assassination of denial and the de facto policy of sanction at the January 10, 1986 hearing on the original complaint. When the district court was asked if it accepted as evidence a government document denying sanction for assassination, which defined the scope of defendant's authority and therefore the scope of federal court jurisdiction, Judge Swart asserted he had never seen the document which was referred to on the civil cover sheet as the basis of jurisdiction. See amended complaint, Exhibit A, Appendix B. The transcript of this hearing was falsified, deleting plaintiff's objection to the exclusion of evidence of jurisdiction. The district court, in its order on plaintiff's objection to transcript, affirmed that the transcript was in error. See page 2, line 12, 13 of 12-22-86 order, Appendix B. In addition to permitting the exclusion of evidence of jurisdiction and the falsified transcript to go unnoted, the Ninth Circuit Court, by refusing to address the alternative cause of action based in taxpayer standing, failed to comply with Federal Rules of Civil Procedure Rule 8E. The pleading is not made insufficient by the because the bottom is all wiped out in the black. The insufficiency of one or more of the alternative statements. The Ninth Circuit Court did not note that defense misstatement at 7-15-88 hearing denying plaintiff's alleged payment of federal taxes in 1986, documented in plaintiff's 4-16-87 response. Plaintiff thereby had a hand in the April 28, 1986 murder of a dear acquaintance of his personal friends, Benjamin Ernest Linder. But
this might make it easier to sell this story. So I went and I met with her in her boyfriend had a court hearing coming up in San Francisco, and so I met her at the courthouse and we sat down and talked. And she started giving me documents from her boyfriend's case that he'd gotten under discovery. And some of the documents she gave me pertained to this guy named Oscar Danilo Blandon, who was going to be a witness against her boyfriend. And when Rochelle's lawyer found out that the guy was going to be a witness against him, he filed a motion for discovery. And the government turned over a lot of documents about Danilo Blandon. And one of the things they turned over was a grand jury transcript from 1994 in which he had gone before a San Francisco grand jury and talked about his career as a cocaine dealer. And in this grand jury transcript, which was heavily blacked out, I mean, they didn't turn it over uncensored. They went through with a magic marker and crossed out big parts of it. But he had talked about how he had been dealing cocaine in Los Angeles since the early 1980s, and how he got his start as a cocaine dealer was because the Contras needed some money. And he talked about, getting 2 kilos of cocaine in San Francisco and going to sort of a cocaine dealer school up there in which he was taught how to weigh it and how to recognize good cocaine from bad cocaine.
Frank Smith. Now, because this is all after 83, so Seth Rosenfeld puts down all the data. You know, U.S. Attorney Joseph Russinello gives 37,000 cocaine profits after they're busted off of the Colombian freighter in frog mount suits. And, of course, San Francisco was where it wasn't Rob Bonner immediately announced the absence of conspiracy. It's the current intel chief, Di-Fi, the Frankenstein mayor, grafted onto the body politic of the best mayor San Francisco ever had. So let's go back to Gary Webb.
And how to hide it in doors of pickup trucks. And I was looking at this document, and I got back to the office, and I called up my editor, and I said, do you remember something long, long time ago about the Contras and cocaine and something like that? And she said, yeah, but, you know, just vaguely.
Well, hold it, Mary. That's way before the WTC pent bomb. That's the FBI term for what our friends with blind Manhattan eyes refer to as an attack. Anyway, the inside job, obviously. So, let me go to the, if it doesn't drop, oh, it didn't, thank you, computer. Because today, we have Rosenstein stepping down, and behind all of these cases, just like behind all the Mueller's and Comey's cases, of course, anything that touches on arming both sides in war crimes, you know, Mueller is saying, oh, they definitely got WMDs in Iraq. And Comey looking the other way for the jihadi, quote-unquote, you know, these are non-Muslims dressed up to murder people in the name of who we are demonizing. The tens of millions of Muslims murdered after the false flag blaming the victim for our crime while the media, MSM, stooge, zombie stooges, are playing dumb. And what they're playing, what you in the press, or actually in the public even, if you know what's good for you, if you know which side the bread is buttered on and all, and you don't want to rock the boat, then you'll know not to, you know, look into the arming both sides in Iraq that got Olaf Palme and Carl Friedrich Algernon whacked, you know, simultaneously, so that Sweden, you know, host of the dynamite fortune. Never mind, behind all Rosenstein cases is murdered U.S. agent Brian Terry, Glenn Walking, and David Rayner, and Sean Suter, S-E-A-N-S-U-I-T-E-R. But hold that thought, kids, because I was going to go to False Flag News where they're going to talk about the same thing being motive in the, as soon as we find it here. Let me hit pause on this recording.
Prime suspect in the Charlie Hebdo thing, which targeted Jews at the kosher deli in Paris. We know for a fact that...
that the caption on this week's False Flag News on why Bibi loves the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre, he's saying, thanks for whipping up that hate. It's great for Israel. And Trump, who's shaking his hand in the frame, says, please tell your left hand to let go of my balls.
The report is sane. And this is amazing because it shows you what these people really think behind closed doors. And they thought that somehow publishing it would be okay, when really what it shows is that they are the most scared of real reporting. These are issues that Americans care about. These are issues that affect our lives. And when you mock environmental issues as somehow a Kremlin conspiracy, that's the level of discourse that we're at. You know, in the DNC leaks,
other than the criminals, that there's a clear and categorical distinction between the cops and criminals, dissolves pretty fast as soon as you take a look at the life and death of Whitey Bulger. He was apparently murdered on Tuesday morning by a hit squad, including Fotios Freddy Gias, who is a West Springfield Mafia hitman serving a life sentence. Whitey Bulger had been muttering things about incriminating high-level people, and one wonders who he might have been about to incriminate before they just rubbed him out in prison. Next slide, we have Kevin Ryan's piece published at Global Research talking about the Robert Mueller history of cover-ups, which includes covering up some of the activities of Whitey Bulger, the Boston area mobster, who was having the FBI kill people for the mob. You know, the FBI at that time was essentially functioning as part of Bulger's mob. And Robert Mueller, as a, what was he then? He was, I guess, a U.S. attorney. He covered all this up. So I wonder whether something relating to Mueller may have been the cause of Whitey's recent demise.
Very interesting. And as we're going to go in the next article, here's some history I didn't know about Whitey Bulger. I knew nothing about this guy. I thought he was just like a typical criminal. I didn't know anything about him. And obviously, it's much, much, much deeper than that. And I liked how the parallels between Mueller and Rudy Giuliani were pointed out in this article by Kevin Ryan, and how they're basically, if you're to believe the way that the narrative is being shaped within the media and the official narrative, Mueller and Giuliani are basically the opposite sides. Mueller's the guy trying to expose Trump. Giuliani's the guy basically trying to protect Trump in his capacity as the president's attorney. Makes you wonder, are these two once again teaming up to cover up something much deeper than just the way that this current narrative on Trump and so-called election meddling's going. So I did like that parallel there between Mueller and Giuliani, two quote-unquote deep state cover-up artists are basically leading this whole investigation, on Giuliani on the Trump side and Mueller on the government side.
And Mueller, of course, was involved in covering up all kinds of stuff, not just the fact that the FBI was essentially functioning as the hit squad for the mob in Boston, but also he helped cover up the Pan Am 103 bombing over Scotland in 1988. Major Charles McKee of the Defense Intelligence Agency and a team of high-level U.S. intelligence specialists went down and died on that flight. They were about to expose a CIA drug ring, bringing opiates out of the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. And so Mueller was brought in to cover that up. He also covered up the BCCI investigation. This was the biggest crooked banking scandal in history. And then, of course, he was brought in immediately before 9/11 to run the FBI cover-up of 9/11. So this guy is a big-time cover-up, deep state.
More apart from the man of integrity, the hashtag the resistance likes to portray him as being. It's so bad.
Yeah,
to see
right. Yeah, some resistance. Well, and you know, the distinction between cops and criminals really breaks down when you look at what they do to criminals in prison. Look at the next slide. Here we have this really interesting story by Whitey himself describing how he was force-fed massive amounts of LSD as part of a prison experiment by the CIA. And he saw, you know, that he apparently had a really bad time, nothing but bad trips. I imagine if you were a mafia guy in prison with a bunch of scumbags and they came and force-fed vast piles of LSD down your throat, you'd probably have a bad trip too. So I kind of feel sorry for him. But the fact that the CIA can get away with this stuff really tells you who the real criminals are.
Yeah, why wasn't this? I don't remember seeing this anywhere reported in the media. Doesn't the media think people would be interested in hearing something like this? Yet complete silence, and they just keep alive this narrative. Oh, he was just a typical mob guy, and all.
So it's OCY, Aussie, I guess. Whitey Bulger, I was a guinea pig for CIA drug experiments. But let me read the former FBI director Robert Mueller article. Has been in the news lately due to his inquiry into Russian-alleged interference in the 2016 U.S. elections. After a 12-year stint leading the Bureau, longest ever since J. Edgar Hoover, Mueller is now seen by many as the honest man, serving the interests of the American public. However, that perception cannot be defended once one knows about Mueller's past. What some people don't know about Mueller is that he has a long history of leading government investigations that were diversions or cover-ups. These include the investigation into the 88 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, the investigation into terrorist financing Bank of Credit and Commerce International, and the FBI investigation into the crimes of September 11, 2001. Today, the public is beginning to realize Mueller's investigation into Russians' alleged collusion with the Trump campaign is a similar diversion. Mueller's talents were noticed early in his career at the Justice Department. As the U.S. attorney in Boston during the mid-80s, he helped falsely convict four men for murders they didn't commit in order to protect a powerful FBI informant, mobster James Whitey Bulger, according to the Boston Globe. So right now, on his very first day at the new place, they turn him over to the Italians. Of course, he's Irish, and you know, he's framing up these innocent people for his murders. And you know, it's obvious the protection holiday, kind of stand down is kind of longer than I need to say, because it's just protection rackets, you know, breaking your legs by withdrawal of protection. It's, you know, it's like called capitalism. It's like medicine. It's like taking mandatory bleeding stations, taking from FDR's pension, you know, like they celebrated my birthday this year by doing that. So good luck paying the rent, Burglar Liberation Radio, with Hellbat Clinton going after the... Never mind. Yes, I was going to launch onto a segue here, but I better just keep reading. Mueller was also in that position while Whitey... According to the Boston Globe, Mueller was also in that position while Whitey Bulger was helping the FBI cart off his criminal competitors, even as he buried bodies in shallow graves along the Nepon set, N-E-P-O-N-S-E-T. If you've been to Boston, you may know what that is. Mueller was then appointed as chief investigator for the 88 bombing of Pan Am 103 in Scotland. The account Mueller produced was a flimsy story that accused a Libyan named Megrahi of coordinating placement of a suitcase bomb that allegedly traveled unaccompanied through several airports to find its way to the doomed flight. Maybe we can get to Maltese Double Cross, Alan Frankovic's excellent little doc that shows the South Africans pick both up, and the South Africans are allied to Israel, canceling at the last minute. That's why all those Syracuse students were on board, because the South Africans canceled, pick both, they canceled right before, you know, the rest of Henry. Well, coordinating placement of a suitcase bomb that allegedly traveled unaccompanied through several airports to find its way to the doomed flight. Despite Mueller's persistent defense of this unbelievable tale, Megrahi was released from prison in 2009 and died 3 years later in Libya. With the Pan Am 103 case, Mueller was covering up facts related to some of the victims of the bombing. A group of U.S. intelligence specialists led by Major Charles McKee of the Defense Intelligence Agency. McGee had gone to Beirut to find and rescue hostages, and while there, learned about CIA involvement in drug smuggling operations run through an agency project called COREA, Korea. As Time magazine reported, the likely explanation for the bombing, supported by independent intelligence experts, was that U.S. operatives targeted Flight 103 in order to kill the hostage rescue team. This would prevent a disclosure of what McKee's team had learned. The theory was also supported by the fact that the CIA showed up immediately at the scene of the crash, took McGee's briefcase, and returned it empty. But this analysis leaves out the fact that the intercepted communications pointed to were unencrypted, as if the Libyans all of a sudden stopped encrypting their stuff, and then there was this little torpedo thingy up in the upper stories of some hotel sending the stuff that was encrypted in Operation Trojan, used to point the finger. Of course, it was by the Mossad. And that is all in... a lot of that is in by way of deception, but... some of the Time magazine for the likely explanation of bombing. This would prevent disclosure of McKee's team at Henry. The theory was also supported by the fact that the CIA showed up immediately and returned it empty. Took McKee's briefcase and returned it empty. Mueller's diversions led to his leadership in the criminal division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Oh, that reminds me. Stephen Trott was head of the criminal division, one of the three people who phoned Leon Kellner during the Southern Air investigation. And those teenagers shot down Hassenfuss, who had the lucky rabbit's foot, and had spilled beans, pointing to Luis Posada Carriles and Felix Rodriguez. And, of course, Carriles walked out of prison after the bombing, the Cubana airliner bombing had the fencing team on board. And the guy, Felix Rodriguez... Million Rodriguez explained had shaken the Medellin cartel down for $10 million, was it, to assassinate Sandinistas in Nicaragua.
But, of course, that was one of the two places Zapata Oil had its offices. That's George H.W. Bush, son of Hitler's banker who blew our brains out in 63. Mr. George Bush was told by the Mr. George Bush of the CIA was told of the displeasure of the assassination anyway, basically, I guess Hoover was sort of covering his ass, saying, okay, we told the CIA not to invade Cuba on the pretext because there would be too much resentment. And that identified George Herbert Walker Bush the day after November 23rd, 1963. But I was just segueing all over the place with the Pan Am 103 case covering up facts. Mueller's diversion led to his leadership of the criminal division of the U.S. Department of Justice, putting him in charge of investigating regarding BCCI. When Mueller started in that role, members of Congress and the media were already critical of the government's approach to the BCCI affair. Mueller came into the picture telling the Washington Post that there was an appearance of, one, foot-dragging, two, perhaps a cover-up. Later, he denied the cover-up claim and the suggestion that the CIA may have collaborated with BCCI operatives. Thirteen talking facts about special prosecutor Robert Mueller. Oh, that's some other article. But again, Mueller was simply brought in to accomplish the cover-up. The facts were BCCI was used by the CIA to operate outside the rule of law through funding of terrorists and other criminal operatives. The bank network was at the root of some of the greatest crimes against the public in the past 50 years, including savings and loan scandal, Iran-Contra affair, and the creation of Al-Qaeda terrorist network. Mueller was instrumental in obstructing BCCI investigation led by Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau. During this time, Justice Department prosecutors were instructed not to cooperate with Morgenthau. Describing Mueller's obstruction of Morgenthau, the Wall Street Journal reported that documents were withheld and attempts were made to block other federal agencies from cooperating, unquote. Describing Mueller's role in the BCCI cover-up more clearly, reporter Chris Floyd wrote, when a few prosecutors finally began targeting BCCI's operatives in the late 80s, President George Herbert Walker Bush boldly moved in with a federal probe directed by Justice Department investigator Robert Mueller. U.S. Senate later found that the probe had been unaccountably botched. Witnesses went missing. CIA records got lost. Lower-ranking prosecutors were told of heavy pressure from on high to lay off. Most of the big BCCI players went unpunished or like Khalib bin Mahfouz, M-A-H-F-O-U-Z, got off with wrist slap fines and sanctions. Mueller, of course, wound up as head of the FBI, appointed to the post July 2001 by George W. Bush, who was appointed by the Supreme Court in the Jim Crow loop. Yes, in the summer of 2001, when the new Bush administration suspected it would soon need a cover-up, Mueller was brought in for the job. Although suspect Louis Free was FBI director in the lead-up to the crimes, Mueller knew enough to keep things under wraps. He also had some interesting ties to other 9/11 suspects, like Rudy Giuliani, whose career paralleled Mueller's closely during the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Under Mueller, the FBI began the whitewash of 9/11 immediately. Mueller himself lied repeatedly in the direct aftermath with respect to FBI knowledge of the accused hijackers. He claimed that the alleged hijackers left no paper trail and suggested they exercised extraordinary secrecy, quote-unquote, and, quote, discipline never broke down, unquote. In fact, ringleader, quote, Muhammad Atta went to great lengths to draw attention to himself prior to the attacks. Moreover, the evidence the accused men supposedly left behind was obviously and plausibly convenient for the FBI. Meanwhile, Mueller's FBI immediately seized control of the investigation at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where United Flight 93 was, well, it says destroyed, but, you know, of course, that's a fable. Under Mueller, leaders of the Bureau went on to arrest and intimidate witnesses, destroy or withhold evidence, and prevent any independent investigation. With Mueller in the lead, the FBI failed to cooperate with the government investigation in 9/11 and failed miserably to perform basic investigatory tasks. Instead, Mueller celebrated some of the most egregious pre-9/11 failures of the FBI by giving those involved promotions, awards, and cash bonuses. As FBI whistle Colleen Rowley later wrote with regard to 9/11/01, Robert Mueller and James Comey as Deputy Attorney General presided over a cover-up, unquote. Kristen Breitweiser, one of the four 9/11 widows known as the Jersey Girl, stated something similar. Mueller and other FBI officials had purposely tried to keep any incriminating information specifically surrounding the Saudis out of the inquirer's investigative hands. To repeat, there was a concerted effort by the FBI and the Bush administration to keep incriminating Saudi evidence out of the inquiry's investigation, unquote. Supporting Breitweiser's claim, public watchdog agency Judicial Watch emphasized Mueller's role in the cover-up, though the recently filed court documents revealed Mueller received a briefing about the Sarasota-Saudi investigation. The FBI continued public deny it existed and appears that the lies were approved by Mueller, unquote. Mueller's FBI went on to botch the investigation into the October 2001 anthrax attacks. As expected, the result was a long series of inexplicable diversions that led nowhere, and botched is in quotes because, of course, it's deliberately thrown. The anthrax attacks occurred at a time when Mueller himself was warning Americans that another 9/11 could occur at any time, despite his lack of interest in the first one. They also provided the emotional impetus for Americans and Congress to accept the Patriot Act, which had been written prior to 9/11. Exactly why Mueller's expertise was needed and not yet known, but examining the evidence suggested the anthrax attackers were the same people who planned 9/11. With knowledge of Mueller's past, people can see that he is not in the news today to reveal important information about Russia and the Trump administration. To the contrary, Mueller is in the news to divert attention away from important information and most likely to prevent Trump administration from being scrutinized in any real way. And anyway, globalresearch.ca, former FBI Robert Mueller.
They're willing to go out on a limb and say that this is all being fomented by the Kremlin. It is.
They are so threatened by Wall Street greed, she has said. But this is about the break-in at the state break-in because. The very 9 hours after the fire extinguisher was knocked over by the probable assassin, the would-be assassin. Wow. For prime time, but so that was the day before last Mouse Report, and then the next I'll go find the because I got a 4-hour thing here. Maybe I'll just jump to that because it will have the news parts embedded in it. And Garrison has a great little Saturday coverage. And here's the emergency vigil for 9/11.
To the stream, Sean.
I certainly got to.
Hi, Susie. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us.
All that before you got there at 1 p.m.
To get near the front door.
Experience them about to find that to the last bit to testify. There was court alongside of you taking place. And that is the statement by CIA torture whistleblower John Kiriakou, an incredible human being.
And now comes Christine Assange, knock on wood.
Okay, and here is the statement from Elizabeth Leah Boss, editor-in-chief of Disobedient Media and one of the founding members of the Unity for Jane movement in solidarity with Julian Assange. Hello, everyone. I am so sorry that I can't be there with you all on the emergency Unity for Jane stream today. But I will be watching and supporting as much as I can from the social media side of things. What Unity for Jay is doing today is vitally important in making sure that the establishment's escalating attacks on one of the most significant journalists of our era do not go unnoticed or unopposed. Such efforts make a tangible difference, and I'm not the only one who believes that the previous emergency Unity for Jay meeting, which took place 3 months ago, when it last appeared Julian Assange would be imminently expelled from the embassy, was instrumental in averting that outcome. In other words, Unity for Jay's vigils, streams, and the Discord community are making a difference, as is every single person working on their own or in smaller groups. what I would say to everyone, if I could be there on the stream today, is something I've said before. Empower yourselves. Know that what you do with your voice matters individually and collectively, and that you have a unique ability to make a difference. All of our skills are needed at this time. Know that when the stream is over is the time where the need for action begins, not ends. One of the independent journalists I look up to the most has said many times that people have to lean into the power of our collective voice. I agree. We have to collectively ensure that the government of Ecuador, the unelected US power structure, and UK authorities understand that they will not be able to harm Julian Assange under the cover of darkness, and that the collective voice says no to his ongoing mistreatment. Now, from Elizabeth Leavos, Editor-in-Chief of Disobedient Media. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Okay, tech guys.
Because they're after Julian, the world's greatest publishing journalist. He's both.
Please go ahead and play for all of our viewers the exclusive message that we have received from Christine Assange, and then I'll return to the stream with Ray McGovern.
This is not a drill. This is an emergency. The life of my son, journalist Julian Assange, is in immediate and critical danger. I thank you all for being here and listening to a mother's plea to ask your help to save him. Despite Julian being a multi-award winning journalist, much loved and respected for courageously exposing serious high-level crimes and corruption in the public interest, he is right now alone, sick, in pain, silenced in solitary confinement, cut off from all contact, and being tortured in the heart of London. The modern day cage for political prisoners is no longer the Tower of London. It is the Ecuadorian embassy. Here are the facts. Julian has been detained nearly 8 years without charge. That's right, without charge. For the past 6 years, the UK government has refused his request for access to basic health needs, fresh air, exercise, sunshine for vitamin D, and access to proper medical and dental care. As a result, his health has seriously deteriorated, and his examining doctors warn these detention conditions are life-threatening. The slow and cruel assassination is taking place before our very eyes in the embassy in London. In 2016, after an in-depth investigation, the United Nations ruled that Julian's legal and human rights had been violated on multiple occasions, that he'd been illegally detained since 2010, and they ordered his immediate release, safe passage, compensation. The UK government refused to abide by the UN decision. The US government has stated Julian's arrest as a priority. They want to get round the US journalist protections under their First Amendment by charging him with espionage. They will stop at nothing to do it. As a result of the US bearing down on Ecuador, his asylum is now under immediate threat. The US pressure on Ecuador's new president resulted in Julian being placed into strict and severe solitary confinement for the last 7 months, deprived of any contact with his family and friends. Only his lawyers could see him. 2 weeks ago, things became substantially worse. The former president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, who rightfully gave Julian political asylum from US threats against his life and liberty, publicly warned that when US Vice President Mike Pence recently visited Ecuador, a deal was done to hand Julian over to the US. He stated that because of the political cost of expelling Julian from their embassy was too high, the plan was to break him down mentally. A new, impossible, inhumane set of rules and protocols was implemented at the embassy to torture him to such a point that he will break and be forced to leave. At the same time, a member of the Ecuadorian government repeatedly tries to cancel his Ecuadorian citizenship so he can be extradited directly to the US. While his lawyers challenge this latest violation of his human rights under the Ecuadorian constitution, their government lawyer has warned Julian that even his very testimony describing his suffering could be in breach of their new protocol and grounds for embassy expulsion. They have denied him visits from his lawyers for 4 days before the next hearing on Monday, jeopardising the preparation of his case and further increasing his isolation, anxiety and stress. They are setting my son up to give them an excuse to hand him over to the US, where he will face a show trial. Over the past 8 years, he has had no proper legal process. It has been unfair at every turn, with much perversion of justice. There is no reason to consider that this would change in the future. The US WikiLeaks grand jury producing the extradition warrant is held in secret, has 4 prosecutors, but no defence and no judge. The UK-US extradition treaty allows for the UK to extradite Julian to the US without a prima facie case. Once in the US, the National Defence Authorisation Act allows for indefinite detention without trial. Julian could very well be held in Guantanamo Bay and tortured, sentenced to 45 years in a maximum security prison, or face the death penalty. My son is in critical danger because of a brutal political persecution by the bullies in power whose crimes and corruption he has courageously exposed when he was editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks. The same corrupt entities who in government tut-tut about bullying, fake news and human rights. These same bullies are bullying my son to death. It would appear that courageous, truthful, multi-award-winning journalism is now life-threatening. The legal channels have been subverted and are therefore unlikely to save him. Because this is a transnational political persecution by a savage superpower in collusion with its allies, saving Julian will require the outrage of the people of the world. I'm asking you to make a noise, a big noise, and to keep making a noise until my son is freed. We need to make our protests against this brutality deafening. I call on all you journalists to stand up now, because he is your colleague and you are next. I call on all you politicians who say you entered Parliament to serve the people to stand up now. I call on all you activists who support human rights, refugees, the environment, and are against war, to stand up now, because WikiLeaks has served the causes that you fight for and Julian is now suffering for it alongside of you. I call on all citizens who value freedom, democracy, and a fair legal process to put aside your political differences and unite and stand up now. Most of us don't have the courage of our whistleblowers or the journalists like Julian Assange who published them, so that we may be informed and warned about the abuses of power. But we can stand up en masse and protect them. Throughout history, when the abuses of power became too much for the people to bear, they united and stood up and stopped them. This is a moment when we must say no. This is enough. We, the people, will not stand by and watch this brave journalist die.
First, the U.S. and U.K. came for Iraq because Saddam did 9/11.
He's the most dangerous person in the world.
Murder lives forever, and so does war. It's survival of the fittest.
I mean, WMDs. It's
a human trait hidden deep down inside of our DNA. One man can build a bomb, another run a race to save somebody's life and have it blow up in his face. I'm not the only one who finds it hard to understand. I'm not afraid of God, I am afraid of man. Is it running in our blood? Is it running in our veins? Is it running in our genes? Is it in our DNA? Humans are gonna behave as we think we always should. Yeah, we can be bad as we can be good. Underneath it all, we're just savages hidden behind shirts, ties and
bandages. First we came for Iraq because, they got oil and we're not Iraqis, and we didn't say anything because we were Iraqis. Then they came for the Reuters camera crew to go along with the million murdered Iraqis in the way of our oil, and the Washington Post didn't say anything because they weren't Reuters and didn't want to publish Julian whistleblower Chelsea Manning's snuff film she had to give to Julian Assange's WikiLeaks. Because the New York Times had just said, contrary, they didn't want to publish it either. Then they came to the Washington Post reporter, Jamal Khashoggi, and no one was left that mattered because Julie was trapped and gagged in the Ecuadorian embassy in Montana. Come back next Tuesday for on Berkeley Radio, 104.1 FM, or first and third Thursday at the Long Hall, 3124 Shattuck, 7:30 p.m. Hey, us to work for them.